Hello and welcome to Saga 50 for 50 on Heritage Bites, produced by Heritage Mississauga. 2024 marks the 50th anniversary since the incorporation of the town of Mississauga, Port Credit, and Streetsville to create the city we now know and love. In this special celebration of Mississauga, we invite you to join us as we walk down memory lane with 50 weeks of podcasts recounting incredible moments in this city's rich history. This is Saga 50 for 50.
Hello, and welcome to Heritage Bites, the podcast that brings you the untold stories of Mississauga's past to life right here in your ears. I'm Justine Lynn, the Collections and Resource Lead with Heritage Mississauga, ready to uncover another fascinating chapter of our city's heritage.
And I'm Melissa Tost, the Social Media and Communications Coordinator here at Heritage Mississauga. This podcast was supported by a volunteer of ours named Arash Dagon, who helped research the story behind this episode. So thank you to Arash. Together, we will be diving into the depths of history to bring you stories of intrigue, resilience, and human spirit. Today, we have a tale that transcends time, oceans, and barriers, bringing a piece of World War II's legacy right into the heart of Mississauga.
Imagine, if you will, a quiet exchange in the shadow of war. A German prisoner of war, far from home, hands over a meticulously crafted ship imprisoned within a glass bottle to Mr. Barker, a local shopkeeper in Arendelle. But this is no ordinary trinket. It's a vessel carrying stories of hope, craftsmanship, and survival.
This ship in a bottle, made by an unknown German POW at the Cooksville Brickyard, is not just a testament to the pastime of those interned far from their homeland. It's a symbol of connection between cultures, between captor and captive, and a poignant reminder of the human desire to create beauty in times of despair.
How did this intricate artifact end up in Mr. Barker's hands? And why? What does it tell us about the lives of those German POWs in Canada and the community that surrounded them? And how has this small ship sailing in a sea of glass touched the lives of those who've kept it afloat through generations?
Join us as we navigate through the history of German POWs in Canada, the craft of ship-in-a-bottle making, and the personal stories intertwined with this remarkable heirloom. From the vineyards of Cooksville to the hands of Delmer Barker and onto the legacy left by Mary Wilkinson, we'll explore the emotional journey of this ship-in-a-bottle across time. In delving into the history of German prisoners of war, or POWs in Canada, during the Second World War, we uncover a tapestry woven with complexities, humanity, and unexpected narratives. Initial reluctance regarding the acceptance of German POWs stemmed from concerns about security and the potential dissemination of Nazi propaganda. However, as time progressed, the treatment of POWs in Canada reflected a commitment to humane treatment and respect, which has come to be the guiding principles in Canadian peacekeeping.
Despite their status as prisoners, German POWs in Canada tended to engage in various activities aimed at maintaining their well-being and occupying their time. Agricultural work became a significant part of their daily lives, with many German POWs renowned for their farming skills. Educational opportunities, including classes in philosophy and history, were provided to the POWs. Additionally, music and sports played integral roles in camp life, with orchestras formed and sports equipment readily available for purchase.
One such camp was located in Cooksville, now part of Mississauga. Here at the Cooksville Brickyard, approximately 50 German merchant marines were imprisoned. Their journey had started aboard civilian transport ships within Hitler's supply network. After being captured off the coast of France or Belgium, the British did not want them interred in Britain. It was a security risk that they were not willing to make. Instead, the merchant marines were sent to Canada in 1942. While their officers were kept in more secure holdings in Gravenhurst, Ontario, the merchant marines found themselves in Cooksville.
These sailors, while interned due to aiding the Nazi cause, were not military men. They were civilian sailors. Today, we know very little about these men. One of the only POWs we know the identity of is one Matthias Randy, after which Randy Road in Cooksville is named for. Like our unknown artist, Randy was a merchant marine POW at the Cooksville Brickyard during the Second World War. Following the war, he returned to Europe only to come back to Canada and then settle in Cooksville, where he was employed as an inspector and became an active volunteer with several political parties, including supporting the political campaigns of Don Blencarn and Harold Kennedy. The former Main Street in Cooksville was renamed Randy Road in his memory.
Unlike German officers, these merchant marines were not deemed to be high risk, either of flight or espionage. Realistically, what would they do outside the brickyard? Historic Mississauga was mostly farm fields and small communities and hamlets. German marines would be easy to spot, and the intelligence gained from spying on Mississauga farm fields would not have been a priority for the Nazi regime, to say the least. Further, unlike a typical POW camp, the Cooksville Brickyard was not solely made up of POWs. The Cooksville Brickyard employed and housed many new immigrants. While a large portion of the workforce was of Italian origins, there were also those of Croatian, Irish, Polish, and Ukrainian ancestry. Safe to say, the POW situation was unique on the Canadian home front.
The Brickyard, a site of toil and production during peacetime, became a place of internment, but also unexpected freedom for these men. Despite their status as prisoners, the POWs enjoyed a great deal of freedom and participated in many social and recreational activities within the Brickyard and surrounding communities.
Life in the camp was structured, yet surprisingly open. The POWs worked at the Brickyard, contributing to Canadian society. The Cooksville Brickyard has a long history in this city, starting thousands of years ago when glacial deposits of dense clay and sandy till mixed with the underlying shale. Little did the land know that these deposits of clay would create an economic boom in the early 20th century.
The Ontario National Brick Company recognized the profitable potential of the site in 1912, purchasing a 200-acre farm at the northeast corner of Dundas Street and Mavis Road. In December of 1912, the company began to build and excavate on the site, developing the property for brick manufacturing. Over the years, shale and clay were excavated from the land by a number of different company names, including the Cooksville Shale Brick Company, Cooksville Brick and Tile Company, the Cooksville Company Limited, Ontario National Brickworks, Cooksville La Prairie Brick Company, Dom Tar, and Canada Brick. Operations ceased in the early 1990s, and the site was later developed for residential and commercial purposes.
In its heyday, though, it was quite profitable. In July of 1913, the Brickyard, which employed some 140 workers, turned out its first shipment of brick. At its height, the Brickyard could produce 300,000 bricks every 10 hours. By the early 1920s, the company employed 350 workers, almost half of the working population of Cooksville. By April of 1922, the company was producing 120,000 bricks per day in 9 or 10 different varieties and touted itself as the largest brick plant of its kind in the world. By the 1930s, the Brickyard was one of historic Mississauga's major industries. And by the 1940s, the Brickyard was the largest supplier of brick in Canada.
Bricks were produced using a method known as the stiff mud system. After the clay was extracted from the earth, it would be ground into a fine powder, mixed with water, and then molded into blocks. The blocks were then dried before being taken by rail to the large kilns for baking. Bricks were transported by horse until the mechanical tip 40 carts were introduced.
The Brickyard had its own internal railway system, with more than 2 miles of track, 3 locomotives, and 26 rail cars. The quarry comprised 26 acres of dense shale deposits, tested to a depth of 300 feet. As demand for their products grew, the company expanded operations, eventually working through the winter months. Employees worked 6 days a week and an average of 13 hours a day, Brickyard employees earned from 25 to 45 cents per hour.
Working so many hours, it became beneficial to house these workers on site. In the summer of 1913, the Brickyard Company began building 15 dwellings for employees. The Brickyard Village consisted of a small street layout and four rows of brick houses and boarding houses. The houses had no running water, but they were wired for electricity. Rent ranged from $11 to $15 per month. By 1926, there were 35 families living at the Brickyard, and many more single mill workers living in a large boarding house. As such, the Brickyard was a perfect place to house German POWs, where they could live and also contribute to Canadian economic life and development.
Yet it wasn't just about the labor. These men engaged in social and recreational activities, forming a small community here. At its height through the 1950s, the Brickyard sponsored a football club, softball and soccer teams, and an orchestra on its grounds.
It was within this unique setting that the art of ship-in-a-bottle making flourished among the POWs. This craft, requiring patience, precision, and a touch of nostalgia, became a favorite pastime for POWs, a way to while away the hours and connect with a life left behind.
The intricate art of crafting ships in a bottle, a pastime that dates back centuries, found a special place within the confines of the Cooksville Brickyard POW camp. But one might wonder, why ships and why in bottles?
For many of these German POWs, the sea was their home. The lives of merchant marines were entwined with the ebb and flow of tides and the vast expanse of the ocean. The ships they built within glass walls were not just models, they were homages to their past lives, vessels of memory floating on seas of glass.
The process of creating these ships in bottles was no small feat. It required not just skill and patience, but also innovation. With limited resources available, POWs became adept to using whatever materials they could find around the camp and repurposing them into tools for their craft.
The inner bottle had to be painted, the ship elements had to be carefully constructed, collapsed, inserted into the bottle, then the mast pulled upwards into shape. From the timber used for the ship's frame to the intricacies of the rigging, each element was crafted with meticulous care. These ships ranged from simple to extravagant, but often include pastoral seaside town scenes reminiscent of their homes back in Europe. Some had inscriptions, such as our ship in the bottle, which reads Toronto, likely after Toronto Township, which was the historic name for Mississauga back then. And that's where the artist was interred, so that would make sense.
The bottles, too, held a special significance. Many bore the marks of local wineries, linking these creations to the community beyond the camp's borders. The bottom of the bottle is embossed with a mark reading, Canadian Wineries Limited. This company name existed from roughly 1928 to 1940 and has an interesting local connection.
Cooksville was the site of the first vineyard in Canada, a tribute to Johann Skinner, who settled in Lot 17, Concession 1, north of Dundas Street in historic Mississauga. After his death, the site was purchased by Sir William George Parker in 1841. The property passed to his son Henry, who built the Clare House Mansion and planted vines on the property in 1858. Together with his brothers, Sir Melville Parker and Albert Parker, Henry developed large wine vaults on the property, which attracted Justin de Courtenay, who had made a proposal to the provincial government to produce Canadian wine commercially.
Parker and de Courtenay soon became friends and collaborators, and the vineyard took off. Henry sold the vineyard to Charles Day in 1865, who, together with Sir Melville Parker and Justin de Courtenay, founded the Canada Vine Growers Association, or CVGA, in 1866, which was the first commercial winery association in Canada.
At its height, the vineyard in Cooksville encompassed more than 88 acres of land, which produced as much as 50,000 gallons of wine sold under the name Chateau Claire Wines. Over the years, the Canadian Vine Growers Association switched hands many times until 1926, when the original Cooksville vineyard experienced a slow decline. Fred C. Marsh took over the CVGA in 1926, and assets were acquired by Canadian Wineries Limited in 1928.
This is the name on our bottle. In 1940, Canadian Wineries Limited changed their name to Chateauguay Wines Limited. Therefore, the Canadian Wineries Limited bottle used for this ship in a bottle was likely produced between 1928 and 1940, and later sold to a POW in Cooksville. While the wine was likely not produced in Cooksville, it was a legacy of the first Canadian winery founded in Cooksville.
Right. And we have to remember that during the war, everyone was subject to rationing. From 1939 to 1947, consumption of sugar, meat, and dairy products was restricted in Canada. This was meant to conserve Canadian-made food for the desperate British population, as well as servicemen overseas, prisoners of war, and refugees. Further, products from abroad were heavily restricted because, as the Wartime Prices and Trade Board explained, the lives of sailors and their ships must not be put at risk to bring in from abroad a single pound of supplies that we can do without. Instead, people got creative to stretch their rations by planting what we would call victory gardens. Hunting and fishing helped stretch their meat allocation, and whenever possible, people picked wild berries and other produce along the roadside.
11 million ration cards were issued across Canada. Inside were coupons for butter, sugar, and meat. Over the course of the war, sugar, coffee, tea, butter, and meat were also rationed. The weekly ration per adult included 1 cup of sugar, 2 ounces of tea or 8 ounces of coffee, 4 ounces of butter, 24 to 32 ounces of meat, and soon spirits were also in the sights of rationing.
You see, no other shortage brought more of an uproar during the war than the lack of spirits. Canadians proved to be willing to put up with less butter or sugar, but the inability to get a glass of beer after finishing a day's work was something that wartime workers could not abide by.
In May 1943, Mackenzie King finally addressed the problem by introducing rationing by coupon to ensure that everyone got their fair share. This restricted the purchases of Canadians aged 21 years and over to 1 pint of hard spirits, 1 quart of wine, or 12 quarts of beer every 2 weeks, depending on the province. The fact that this unknown POW had a wine bottle in the first place speaks to not only the items and luxuries afforded to these enemies of state, but also to a potential reason why the ship in a bottle was made.
Aside from being a way to pass the time, POWs found that they could trade with other POWs, guards, camp staff, and local residents to augment their rations, as their status as POWs did not allow them to be paid for their labor while interred. Prices of goods outside of their rationing coupons would have been especially high.
According to historian Michael O'Hagan, for some of those working in isolated, low-security labor projects like bush camps or farms, POWs also traded and sold with Canadian civilians, providing them access to Canadian currency or forbidden items like radios or even cameras. One interesting story tells of two enterprising POWs working on farms near St. Thomas, Ontario, who enlisted the help of local milkman to sell their ships in a bottle, an act that allowed them to raise enough cash to attempt an escape.
Eventually, internment authorities permitted the sale of handicrafts in most internment camps. Sales were held at the camp, and guards, camp staff, and even some civilians were permitted to view and purchase POW-made articles, with the proceeds being credited to the respective POW's account and made available to them in the form of canteen chits. But what did this POW want in exchange for his ship in the bottle?
To explain this, we need to introduce a new character in our scene.
Dad, Delmer Barker was born on May 27, 1899 in Brampton to John Morris Barker and Minnie Harmsworth. When he was young, he survived three high fever diseases, diphtheria, whooping cough, and scarlet fever. This guy really just had no luck. So the doctor who attended to the family during the diphtheria outbreak said that the young Barker girls were robust and would survive, but that Delmer was puny and sickly in nature and would not live. Against all odds, though, it was the two little Barker sisters who died, and Delmer actually did end up surviving.
However, he would remain in poor health throughout his life. During the First World War, he was rejected for military service because of a damaged heart. Despite his health, Delmer was extremely popular and highly respected in the community and beyond. Delmer's father, J.M. Barker, bought the Arendelle General Store, an attached home, in 1913 from W.J. Cavan. At that point, Delmer and his family moved to Arendelle.
Delmer was the first licensed mechanic in Ontario to operate the Arendelle garage until poor health no longer allowed him to do. As a young man, he was a Sunday school superintendent at St. Peter's Anglican Church in Arendelle. He also served as a hydro commissioner for Toronto Township Hydro for 14 years and was Grand Master of the Loyal Orange Lodge for Peel County for many years as well.
He enjoyed photography and developing his own pictures, talking to people, playing cards and other games, reading, and learning. He was very good-natured, loved, admired, and respected. He was, according to Hugh O'Neill, another creative thinker. He married Marjorie Alice Adamson on August 12, 1925, at Trinity Anglican Church in Port Credit.
Delmer Barker was more than just a shopkeeper. He was a pillar of the community. His general store in Arendelle was a place that served as a hub for local residents and, during the war, also for POWs housed nearby in Cooksville. The building we see today, O'Neill's Vacuum Store on Dundas, once stood in what is now the middle of the westbound lanes on Dundas Street, as Dundas Street through Arendelle was once much narrower. The building was moved back from Dundas Street when the road was widened in the 1950s. The square tower portion, you may say, was added on in 1938 for expanded living space. To the rear of the building before the relocation was the Arendelle Motor Garage that, if you remember, Delmer operated at one point. Delmer's daughter recalled as a child that there was a potbelly stove, a checkerboard, and ice cream also being sold in the store.
Delmer was someone everyone knew, and he knew everyone. Whatever you needed to buy, he was the person to see. It is no wonder then that this unknown POW came to him with his ship in a bottle. This would have been some time after the POW's arrival in 1942, but prior to Delmer's death in 1944. Trading goods was fairly common during the period of rationing, but what did he want in exchange for the ship?
A pack of cigarettes. That was it. A pack of cigarettes for the ship in a bottle. This exchange, simple yet profound, marked the beginning of the artifact's journey through time.
What must have gone through Barker's mind as he received this intricately crafted piece? Here was a work of art born from the hands of the so-called enemy, a German POW. Yet it spoke of shared humanity, of the universal longing for freedom, and the comfort of home.
It may have been crafted by the enemy, but nobody could deny its beauty. Amid the blue sky and clouds sits mountains with small houses, churches, even a lighthouse to form a little village. Springing from its shores are the waves upon which float a small tugboat with fluffy white plumes of smoke billowing from its stack. And the greatest treasure of all is the massive three-mast ship, the Toronto, as it has been dubbed by the artist. A mix of the artist's memory and reality, perhaps.
However, Delmer would not be allowed to cherish it long before his health caught up to him. He died on September 14, 1944, at 44 years of age. The cause of death was congestive heart failure. His funeral was held on September 17th from the home of his brother, Vern, in Arendelle.
All of the local schools, the municipal and hydro offices were closed for the afternoon, and all of Tyrone Township's elected officials attended his funeral. School children from public schools in Cooksville, Arendelle, Sheridan, and Streetsville all filed past his coffin, and the hydro officials and workers attended en masse. Even a group of Romani from Toronto, whom he had befriended when they camped in Arendelle every summer, joined the many mourners. His fellow Orangemen were an honorary escort and held a special service at St. Peter's Anglican Church before his interment in the cemetery there. In all, hundreds of people are said to have paid their respects.
However, our ship's journey does not end with Delmer, for among the many mourners were his daughters, Grace, Ruth, Betty, and Della Mary. Della Mary, or just Mary, was only 4 years old. His death was an important point in her life, as she missed her father terribly. The ship in a bottle was passed down to Mary Barker, later Wilkinson, becoming a part of her inheritance and a tangible link to her father's memory and the history of her community.
For Mary, the ship in a bottle was not just an heirloom. It was a storybook, a vessel carrying tales of the past, of her father's kindness, and of the POW's lives intertwined with her own family's history. However, the ship also took on a life of its own in her care.
Della Mary Wilkinson, née Barker, was born in Arendelle on Father's Day, June 16, 1940, the youngest of four daughters born to Delmer and Marjorie Barker. Mary spent much of her childhood years primarily living nearby on the Adamson farm with her grandparents, Sarah and Charlie Adamson, and Della Mary fondly recalls having a pet cow.
Mary attended primary school in an overflow classroom at the Arendelle Community Hall, and in grade two, she attended SS No. 4 Arendelle Public School on Mississauga Road. For high school, she attended T.L. Kennedy Secondary School in Cooksville. In 1961, at the age of 21, she went to Fort Chimo in the Eastern Arctic to help relocate St. Stephen's Anglican Church and build a new rectory for them.
Returning home to Arendelle from Fort Chimo, renamed Kujawaq, in 1980, she attended Lakeshore Teachers College in New Toronto, obtaining her teaching certificate in 1962. Seeking more adventure and having a love for the far north, she accepted her first teaching position at Queen Elizabeth School in Val-d'Or, Quebec. In 1963, she opened the first kindergarten in the Eastern Arctic at Fort George, Quebec. She resided in the Fort George community until 1965.
While in Fort George, she served as both a teacher and community nurse, and she also learned elements of both Cree and Ojibwa languages. She was given the Indigenous name, which she recorded as Okigagamawashik, by a local elder. Mary understood the name to mean proud bird, beautiful when you fly. Mary often remarked that her time in Fort George was among some of her happiest memories. While there, she developed a deep appreciation for Indigenous cultures and languages. In 1965, she taught public school at Moosonee and at Horn Payne in Northern Ontario before returning south to Hamilton, Ontario in 1966. Mary then enrolled at the Hamilton and District School of Nursing, graduating in 1968.
On August 19, 1967, she married Thomas Edward John Wilkinson of Wingham, whom she had met in Horn Payne. They had a pretty little ceremony in St. Peter's Anglican Church, Arendelle. In 1967, Mary and Tom purchased a historic house and former family home in Arendelle Village. Mary would live at this house on Mindamoya Road in Arendelle from 1967 until 2014.
Mary began her nursing career in 1968 at Mississauga General Hospital, but chose to resume her teaching career in 1970, joining the Dufferin-Peel Catholic School Board. She later attended the University of Toronto, graduating in 1988 with her BA, achieving high distinction and being on the Dean's Honors List, all while continuing to teach. Mary taught primary school in Mississauga for 43 years. The schools in Mississauga where she taught include St. Gerard, St. Christopher, St. Francis of Assisi, St. Jerome, and St. Timothy.
After retiring from teaching, Mary found a love of travel, genealogy, and volunteering. She belonged to the Mississauga South Historical Society,
the Halton Peel branch of Ontario Ancestors, formerly the Ontario Genealogical Society, and to the Thompson Adamson Bell Tower Museum at St. Peter's Anglican Church, Arendelle. She led the organization of the Arendelle Public School Reunion in 2005, and she was the recipient of the Heritage Award from Heritage Mississauga in 2006. Mary Wilkinson passed away peacefully on August 8, 2023, at age 83.
Such a vibrant life. How then did our little ship in the bottle fit into such a bright personality in our city? To explain this new era in the ship's life, we want to welcome onto the program Mary Wilkinson's son, Matthew Wilkinson, historian with Heritage Mississauga. Welcome, Matthew. I'm just very curious, about the ship in the bottle and your family memories about this ship, like especially your mom, who very much cherished it. Where did she take the ship with her? Was it always with her?
Of all the things, my mom was a collector and very much always interested in history, and that of course passed down to me, and the ship played a role in that. But for her, it was a treasured memory, not only of her dad, who was given the ship and, growing up in Arendelle, in the Arendelle General Store, which was very much part of her upbringing. But I think it also played into that storytelling aspect that my mom always kind of carried through. It wasn't just about history, but it was about making you care about where you lived in. And the ship played a role in that storytelling, the ship in the bottle. So after our own fire, my family house burned in 1975. The ship was saved. One of the few things that was saved, and I'm pretty sure that was a specific goal, was to save the ship. It traveled with her. She would show her students. I remember I believe it was 1975, 76, right around the fire, right after the fire. It was at St. Gerard's public school or elementary school with my mom, and it traveled with her through St. Christopher's and St. Francis of Assisi and St. Jerome's and St. Timothy's, particularly St. Timothy's, where it would either live on her desk or be hidden away safely that she'd bring out to talk about. It was a thing of curiosity. And in the summer times and in the winter, it would come home. Believe it or not, it was so often in the same place at home that when the sun was on it, it actually left an indent where the stand was on the shelf. And so I always knew to put it back at the exact same place. But it kind of had a legend of itself. The ship in the bottle was a way to convey stories, not just about the creation of it, but just the idea of the love of history and what holding a historical object might mean and the stories you can tell. She used to hold it and tell stories, imaginary stories. I don't know if it went back to Christopher Robinson or things like that, but certainly about traveling and sailing and the high seas. She always told stories, and the ship became one of those storytelling elements. I'm pretty sure no stories were the same. She didn't know the story, the history of the ship. She knew where it came from, but that was it. But she used it as a tool in storytelling to children. And I think about it, she had taught for 43 years, and for I would say a good 30 years of that, the ship was somehow intrinsic in that teaching. So how many students grew up with this curiosity of history of this odd little ship in a bottle? It's probably impossible to tell. It certainly had an impact on my life.
Yeah, I mean, and that's very much, I feel like, the teacher in her right very there. So, but you mentioned yourself. So, I mean, for yourself, you grew up also as a family heirloom. So what did that mean to you?
It was always a curiosity. And curiosity is, I guess, maybe the mother of passion. I don't know. The ship is something I passed daily and looked at daily, almost every day of my life growing up, particularly after my mom was retiring or towards the end of her career, when it came to live at our home all the time. It was by the back door where we let the dogs out. So you're there. And I would pull it down and I would look at it. And it mesmerized me. I was more interested in the creation story and kind of learning more about it. But that idea that it would evoke curiosity. And I think that was really played a role in my development of my interest in history. And I probably learned more about its origins than my mom knew at the time, just because I was really fascinated and tried to, and never really figuring it out, right, to be honest. But it was fascinating to look at what people create and then the communities that were created out of this interaction or this exchange of things. Like, you know, it wasn't created by my grandfather. It was traded for something that somebody else wanted, but somebody created this from a different place in the world. It was here for a moment in time. I just found that was just absolutely fascinating story. And so it was important to my mom. And so as my mom transitioned in different care and you know, eventually had to move from the family home to different, it went with her. We made sure it went with her. It was something that was important to her. And for the last part of her life, it was in a little cure cabinet in her room. And I always said, I always believed strongly. So that was one thing that was dear to me that I wanted, but I wanted to make sure that it was preserved, because I think the story is bigger than my mom. I think the story is bigger than me. It talks to a moment in our time in our city. And I know it's not alone. I know that there are other examples of it, but it has a bigger story than just a single ship in a bottle to me.
Wow. Yeah. And it kind of reminds me, you were talking about the curiosity element, and that's a lot of what you say to me and to others, yeah, a lot of times, is that when we become curious about something, then we're halfway to caring about
it explains it better than just saying ship in a bottle, right? Like, but honestly, that the ship in the bottle to me plays a big role in the development of that mindset. They're neat things when you have a chance to look at it and to explore and start delving into it. Look at the name on the ship, and you know, somebody had the foresight in creating this thing that wasn't from here to create something that tied both to the place where they were from, or a memory they had, or an image they were creating of some other place, and then tying it to this place. And you know, it's a neat story. Think of the hands that crafted it that may have only been here for months or a year, and for all we know never came back, and this thing has survived, and those people, the person who created it, my grandfather who held it, my mom who not even sure why her other sisters didn't crave it, but it ended up with my mom. You know, they've all passed on, right? Those people that had that creation story to it, but this element, this object remains, and the stories it can tell over time, and it's going to be built, you know, 42 to 44, somewhere in that time frame, likely. Mm-hmm. And it arguably is in the same condition that it was when it was created, and from a bottle that even older than it,
yeah,
that tells a story of this place and kind of connects to kind of other early stories of history. There's so many layers of stories to this ship.
Yeah, and bottle. And I mean, even the ship is called Toronto.
That's what I mean. Yeah. And not for the city of Toronto, right? We're Toronto Township, and I think you know, personally, I think they should have called it Arendelle, but that's my own. To me, it evokes, I never met my grandfather, right? So, but this is something he held. And I grew up with stories of my grandfather through my mom. But it was something that he held, and something that my mom held, and something, mm-hmm, that I've held. And to me, it's bigger than all that. It has a story that connects to the story of our city. And not only this moment in time, but the people that helped to shape it, the general stores, lives are shaped by tragedy and opportunity. We had a fire and this thing got saved. Why did it get saved? But then it gets passed on. It can tell a bigger story than just the Barker Wilkinson family, I think. To me, when my mom passed on, and I talked to my brother, and I'm like, I want that. But I didn't want it for me. I wanted to make sure that it was passed on, preserved, and given a place of storytelling opportunity to our city. And I think that's important. Now, one of the interesting things I'd love to see, if it's still there, is for decades, the desk that it stood on, which also came from the Barker post office in Arendelle, is with the Bradley Museum. If you look closely, the position where that bottle stood should still be visible on the shelf. So things tie into each other, yeah, as well. But yeah, that Ship in the Bottle is well loved, well viewed, well traveled, and still a wonder.
Yeah. And connects to a bigger story.
Very much so. Very much so. And again, think back to those times of uncertainty and, during the Second World War and merchant marine German sailors being positioned stations, the wrong word, but they weren't necessarily incarcerated either, but they were at the Cooksville Brickyard during the Second World War, and they didn't have money to spend, but they had talents. These are people who crafted something to trade for something that they wanted, whether it was cigarettes, I've heard those stories, whether it was alcohol, I've heard those stories. Whatever it was for, this was traded, and my grandfather saw value in it, right? It was in lack of currency. This thing was traded for something that somebody else wanted. I just think it's a really neat story that spreads over time, right? Like, mm-hmm. like I said, all these, the people that are immediately connected to it are gone. But the ship evokes so many memories, the Barker General Store and Delmer Barker, but the Cooksville Merchant Marine POWs mm-hmm. during the Second World War, the Cooksville Brickyard itself,
yes.
the winery from where the bottle comes from, the students that my mom taught over generations that were all kind of part and parcel of the story of the Ship in the Bottle. It's just a fascinating story.
And I mean, and also too, it probably would have been one of the only things that your mom had to remind herself of her father, because he passed away when she was 4 years old.
She was four, and you also have to remember that we had the fire in 75. Mm-hmm. So there was very little that passed on. In fact, there was coat, there was a hat, and there was a Ship in the Bottle, and there was the desk, the post office desk. Those are the things that my mom treasured. But the Ship in the Bottle was that thing you could hold and wonder about and stare at. And it was a marvel. Even as a kid, I remember looking at it going, you know, this is such the coolest thing. Like, you're looking, I'm amazed I didn't break it. I mean, like, you know, like if anyone was going to drop it, I'm the one who held it probably the most. But it's a marvel, and it's still a marvel.
Absolutely. Yeah. The journey of the Ship in a Bottle from a German POW's hands to becoming a cherished Wilkinson family heirloom tells us much about the passage of memory and the role of artifacts in preserving our history.
Throughout her life, Mary shared the story of the Ship in a Bottle with friends, family, and anyone interested in the rich history of Mississauga. It wasn't just about the artifacts itself, but about the stories it harbored, the tales of her father, the German POWs, and the community that witnessed the war's impact on their doorstep.
Even as Mary used the Ship in a Bottle as an educational tool, bring into classrooms and community centers, she was doing more than just teaching history. She was inviting others to consider their own connections to the past, to the artifacts that hold our collective memories, and to the stories that shape our understanding of who we all are.
And so the Ship in a Bottle sails on through generations across the tumultuous seas of history, carrying with it a message of hope, a testament to the enduring human spirit, and a call to remember not just the broad strokes of history, but the individual lives that give it color and meaning. It reminds us that beyond every artifact, every piece of history, there are human stories waiting to be told.
Thank you for joining us on this voyage through time and memory. We hope it leaves you with a sense of curiosity about the stories of the city of Mississauga hidden in plain sight all around us.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep connecting with the stories that make us who we are.
We hope you enjoyed this week's installment of Saga 50 for 50. Help us keep celebrating the 50th anniversary of the city of Mississauga by following Heritage Bites wherever you get your podcasts. Also, be sure to check out Heritage Mississauga on all our social media platforms and follow hashtag Saga50for50 to stay up to date on all of Mississauga's 50th anniversary celebrations. This is Heritage Mississauga signing off. Until next time.